Progressive presents Get Pumped. Inspiration to help you do insurance stuff.
Okay, time out. You're gonna let your budget be the boss of you? Take control with Progressive's Name Your Price tool. Tell us what you want to pay for car insurance, and we'll help you find options that fit your budget. Here's some music to get you pumped. Da-dong-da-dong-da-dong-da-dong-dang-dang. I hear your budget laughing at you. Oh, wait, that's just those kids laughing at me. Ignore them!
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
On this edition, it's an honor to have Dr. Maya Angelou on the program. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. Dr. Maya Angelou is one of the most renowned and influential voices of our time. Hailed as a global Renaissance woman, she's a celebrated memoirist, novelist, educator, dramatist, producer, actress, historian, filmmaker, and civil rights activist. Born on April 4, 1928 in St. Louis, Missouri, Angelou was raised in St. Louis in Stamps, Arkansas. Angelou experienced the brutality of racial discrimination while in Stamps, but she also absorbed unshakable faith and values of traditional African-American family, community, and culture. As a teenager, Angelou's love for the arts won her a scholarship to study dance and drama at San Francisco's Labor School. At 14, she dropped out to become San Francisco's first African-American female cable car conductor. She later finished high school, giving birth to her son, Guy, a few weeks after graduation. As a young, single mother, she supported her son by working as a waitress and cook. However, her passion for music, dance, performance, and poetry would soon take center stage. In 1954 and 1955, Angelou toured Europe with a production of the opera Porgy and Bess, studied modern dance with Martha Graham, danced with Alvin Ailey on television variety shows, and in 1957 recorded her first album, Calypso Lady. In 1958, she moved to New York, where she joined the Harlem Writers Guild, acted in the historic off-Broadway production Jean Genet's The Blacks, and wrote and performed Cabaret for Freedom. In 1960, Angelou moved to Cairo, Egypt, where she served as editor of the English-language weekly The Arab Observer. The next year, she moved to Ghana, where she taught at the University of Ghana's School of Music and Drama, worked as feature editor of the African Review, and wrote for the Ghanaian Times. During her years abroad, Angelou read and studied voraciously, mastering French, Spanish, Italian, Arabic, and the West African language Fanti. While in Ghana, she met with Malcolm X, and in 1964 returned to America to help him build his new organization of African American Unity. Shortly after her arrival in the United States, Malcolm X was assassinated and the organization dissolved. And soon after X's assassination, Martin Luther King Jr. asked Angelou to serve as Northern Coordinator for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. King's assassination, falling on her birthday in 1968, left her devastated. With the guidance of her friend, the novelist James Baldwin, she began work on the book which would become I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, which was published in 1970 to international acclaim and enormous popular success. The list of her published verse, nonfiction, and fiction now includes more than 30 best-selling titles. A trailblazer in film and television, Angelou wrote the screenplay and composed the score of the 1972 film Georgia, Georgia. Her script, the first by an African-American woman ever filmed, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. She continues to appear on television and in films, including the landmark television adaptation of Alex Haley's Roots and John Singleton's Poetic Justice. In 1997, she directed her first feature film, Down in the Delta. And in 2008, she composed poetry for and narrated the award-winning documentary, The Black Candle, directed by M.K. Asante. Angelou has served on two presidential committees, was awarded the Presidential Medal of Arts in 2000, the Lincoln Medal in 2008, and has received three Grammy Awards. President Clinton requested that she compose a poem to read at his inauguration in 1993, and Angelou's reading of her poem, On the Pulse of the Morning, was broadcast live around the world. Angelou has received more than 30 honorary degrees and is Reynolds Professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University. Maya Angelou is also going to be speaking here at Butler University September 25th. It's part of the Celebration of Diversity Distinguished Lecture Series. It begins at 7:30 p.m. It's a joy to have her on today's program, and she joins us from her private residence in North Carolina. Dr. Angelou, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on and with the program.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate you on receiving the Letarian Award. It's a National Book Award for your famous book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. What an achievement and long overdue.
Thank you very much. Actually, the award is for lifetime achievement.
Ah,
okay. It's all the books, some 31 books.
There you go.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, your writing is so deeply touching to so many, and you've said that when you write poetry, you do it to become closer to all.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, can you share more about this experience for you of being closer to all?
Well, I believe God is all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And each time I do anything, I mean, some things seem to have more immediate impact than others, but each time I cook dinner for someone, I want to do it at the top of my level, the best I can possibly do. I believe that the Creator has put each of us on earth to do the best we can do. Whatever it is, digging ditches, or being a lawyer, or having a radio show, and writing books and or speaking, I just think that the better I can do, or the best I can do,
mm-hmm.
will put me closer to what all wants me to do.
Mm. I would love to hear about your discovery of the Unity Church and how that impacted your spirituality. Could you briefly share a little bit about that?
Yes, I had discovered the church through a man who became my mentor,
mm-hmm.
Frederick Wilkerson. He was a voice teacher, a voice clinician, he was called.
Mm-hmm.
He had helped people who had trouble with their voices to repair the voice.
Mm-hmm.
And he was wonderful, and he introduced me to Unity, and I enjoyed the church. And then I went away from the States. I went to Europe with Porgy and Bess as their first black... I was really the premier dancers, and I sang the role Ruby, Sporting Life's girlfriend. I left my son for almost a year, and I was so filled with guilt. It was just terrible. When I finally was able to get home, my son hardly spoke to me.
Hmm.
Oh, it was terrible. So I went to a place in San Francisco then called Langley Porter Psychiatric Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And the receptionist asked if I had an appointment. I said no. She said she couldn't see me. There was no one to see me. So I said, someone must help because I'm about to hurt myself and maybe another person. So she called around and told me to go to a certain office. I went to the office, and there was a young white man just looking so spiffy, button-down shirt and all of this and a good suit. And he said, ask me, what's the matter? And I couldn't tell him. I didn't know how I would say to him what it felt like to be the mother of a black boy,
mm-hmm.
growing up in a racist society.
Mm-hmm.
And how guilty I felt about leaving him. So he asked me two or three times, and finally I walked out of the office. I thanked him and walked out of the office. And I went to Wilkie, the voice teacher. So I told him, I'm going crazy. He asked me, what's the matter? I said, no, I'm going crazy. He said, no, I mean, what is the real matter? I really became angry. He said, here, sit down, take this yellow pad, and write your blessings.
Hmm.
And I thought, I said, that's not what I wanted. He said, just write that you could hear me say, write.
Mm-hmm.
And think of all the people in the world who can't hear their baby's cry, can't hear the murmur of a lover in their ear. Think of that. And he said, now write that you could hold this pad, the yellow pad, and have this pen. Think of all the people who can't who are crippled and can't hold even a yellow pad or a book.
Mm-hmm.
Now write down that you can see. And then write down that you can taste. Mr. Brennan, he continues to list for me some of the things that I had taken for granted.
Yes.
And finally, when I came to write down that God loves me,
mm-hmm.
and I said, God loves me. And when I finally let it sink into my psyche,
mm-hmm.
not just into my ears,
mm-hmm.
I thought, God, this element, this creativity, this it who made fleas and flies and mountains and rivers and trees loves me,
mm-hmm.
me, Maya Angelou. Goodness gracious. It still brings me to almost to tears, and maybe two tears,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
without any apology,
mm-hmm.
that I am lovable to the extent that it all loves me. Then there's nothing I can't do, nothing good that I can't attempt to do.
Yes.
And from that day to this, I've never complained about anything. I might report, but I don't complain. This year I'm celebrating my 85th year on the planet.
Oh.
And I like the statement made by Art Linkletter. He said, growing old is not for sissies. So I agree with that. But I don't complain.
Yes. Yes.
If I have a choice, I'd rather grow old than whatever the choice is.
In the 85 years, you have learned a lot. And I loved what you said on Super Soul Sunday about love, what it is, your definition of it, or at least what it empowers. Could you share your thoughts now of what you're learning about this beautiful power of love?
Love is, if you claim it,
mm-hmm.
it's there for all of us. No matter what stroke of bad luck we think seem to be going through,
mm-hmm.
love is there and waiting for us to take it, to admit it, to allow it to be in our lives. And you know, I know that we are told that we should be peacemakers. I agree, and I think we should be peace bringers.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should have peace when we leave our house before even we arrive at a place where it's warlike or bellicose. And so I think that all of that is God.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows me to have the nerve to develop courage and to look at another human being who may have a different complexion than I have.
Mm-hmm.
And her hair may be different, and he may eat different foods prepared in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I am a human being, and nothing human can be alien to me. When I know that, I know that I have enough courage to treat every human being with respect and appreciation and kindness and courtesy. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a moment about your most recent book, bestseller, Mom and Me and Mom. Released this year, this book talks about your relationship with your mother. You know, from a very early age, you were sent to live with your grandmother. Can you briefly recount the experience, the emotions you felt as you took the ride across the country to live with your grandmother?
I was three and my brother five.
Oh.
And my mother and father agreed to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably the best thing that could have happened to my country that they at least gave us to my father's mother and didn't continue. They might have imploded on my country. And so it was the best thing that could have happened to me. My grandmother loved me, my father's mother. And she never once kissed me. I stayed with her 10 years. I don't remember her ever once kissing me. But she would call me when she had visitors.
Mm-hmm.
She'd call me out into the room where she was. And she'd say, "Now, sister, pull up your sleeve." And I'd pull up my sleeve, and she'd hold my arm and then ask, "Have you ever seen an arm straighter than this? Look at this arm, straight as a plank. And look at it, smooth and pretty, brown, as smooth and brown as peanut butter." And that was equivalent to being set in her lap and rocked.
Oh.
I mean, you know, she loved me and had the patience to care for my for some of my ailments, because I, at one time, from the time I was 7 until I was 13, I didn't speak to anyone except my brother. I had been molested when I was 7, and I told the name of the criminal to my brother, who told it to my family, my mother's family. And the man was put in jail for one day, released, and a few days later he was found dead. And the police came to my mother's mother's house and said the man, it seemed, he had been kicked to death. Mr. Brennan, that was in my hearing. And I thought my voice had killed a man. So it would be better for everybody if I didn't speak. Because I might just kill people. My voice could kill people.
Sure.
That was my 7-year-old logic. It was an amazing punishment I put on myself. And after I'd been with my mother's people about 3 or 4 months, after a while, they wearied at the presence of this sullen, silent child. So they sent me back to my grandma in Stamps, Arkansas. And this woman who had gone to the third grade in school, who was the daughter of a former slave, owned the only black-owned store in the town of Stamps during the Depression. And she'd braid my hair the way old black ladies still braid girls' hair. I'd sit on the floor on a pillow, and she'd sit down on a chair. And my hair was huge and very curly. And she said, "Sister Mama, don't care. These people call you a moron. You call you an idiot. Mama don't care what they say." And they holler all these words at you.
Sure.
It hurts your feelings. I don't care. Mama don't care. Mama know when you and the good Lord get ready, you're going to be a teacher. You're going to teach all over this world. I used to sit there and think, this poor ignorant woman, doesn't she know I would never speak?
My.
I had, now, my office sent me over a list of the honorary doctorates I've received. I have 71. And I've taught in Rome at the Rome Opera House, in Tel Aviv at the Habima Theater. And I'm Reynolds Professor at Wake Forest University. And it's a lifetime appointment. Just amazing.
You've come a long way from
a long way from this sullen, silent child.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, sir. In Stamps, Arkansas.
Yeah.
A town about as big as your studio.
You know, you also say that your mother was a terrible parent of young children, but a great parent of young adults.
That's true. You know, I think people blame themselves when they are bad parents, that is, careless parents with children. But my mother said, and I had to ask her not to say that, because it still hurt just to hear her.
Sure.
She said I was about 2 or 3 years old, and I had asked for something, and she didn't give it to me, and I hit her on the leg. She said, without thinking, she backhanded me right off the porch into the dirt. And she said when she looked at me in the dirt and realized what she had done, she said, I don't have it. I don't have it to be a mother. I just don't have that. And that's for that, I'm sure, helped in their my mother and father breaking up,
mm-hmm.
and them sending me to my grandma.
Yes.
So,
yes.
But as a parent of a young adult from the time I was 14,
mm-hmm.
she was incredible. She understood me. She had patience, and I could recite things to her because I was starting to talk. And she'd ask me to recite statements like Rudyard Kipling's If,
mm-hmm.
and some of the poetry of Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so proud, and she made me smile. She'd say, oh, come and let the mother see you smile. Come on, come on. And she would, and I would smile. She'd say, look at my baby. Mother's baby has a beautiful smile. It was so, she won me.
Yeah.
She won my heart.
Yes. In the book, you recount the experience of reconciling with your mother after having lived with your grandmother. Can you tell us how you felt when you and your mother finally reconciled?
Oh, I was so relieved.
Mm-hmm.
I was relieved because she called me darling,
oh.
and she called me baby, and I was just sweet. And I hadn't been called any of those things. And I resisted it because it was so new to me. You like tasting something that looks tasting something that looked strange,
mm-hmm.
and was never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, I had to agree that she loved me. And that she was a good woman because she was very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And she had money. She owned a hotel and pool halls.
Mm-hmm.
And she was young. She was had health, and yet she never laughed at anybody. I mean, you know how some people, as soon as a person, a crippled person, or a person who's hungry or poor, walks out of the room, people, if they don't say something rude, they make a face and shake their hands and, you know, like, what a shame.
Yes.
My mother never did that.
Oh.
And I admired that in her.
Right.
When I was pregnant at 16, just graduating from high school,
mm-hmm.
and unmarried,
mm-hmm.
I told her, I got it told to her, and she asked me, do you know who the father is? I said, of course. I only had sex once. And she asked me, do you love him? I said, no. She asked, does he love you? I said, no. She said, very good. Then we're going to have no point in ruining three lives. We're going to have a beautiful baby. She was all of that.
That's beautiful.
Really?
Yeah.
And she loved him.
Yes.
And loved me. And she told me once, you can take your baby. I said I was leaving her house.
Mm-hmm.
But when you cross my doorstep, remember, you've already been raised. You know the difference between right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Do right.
Mm-hmm.
And know this, you can always come home.
Mm.
And many times I did go home, bringing my baby and trailing whatever few pieces of furniture we had. And my mother was, you'd think that it was Christmas or something.
Mm-hmm.
She'd call her friends and say, hey, you can't guess what? The baby's at home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, don't come right now. I'm going to be with her for a few hours. Let me have her to myself. But then you can come tonight and have dinner. Yes.
Oh,
she was excellent.
Oh. We've talked about your experience as a child. How about your experience as a mother? Do you have any memories that stand out?
Oh, yes. My son, the best thing that ever happened to me in my life was the birth of my son,
mm.
and having the responsibility to raise him.
Mm-hmm.
I told him when he was about 7 or 8 or 9, all through those years, that he had a place inside him that must be kept clean,
mm-hmm.
pristine. Nobody, no wife or husband, no child, no priest or rabbi or pastor,
mm-hmm.
nobody had the right to enter that place,
mm-hmm.
because it may be the place you go to meet God when you die.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let anybody misuse that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I told him also that I would tell him what to do. And if he didn't agree, he could talk to me and try to talk me out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if he didn't convince me, I had the last word. And so I married it a few times, and my then husbands would say to my son, I want you in by 10. And my son would ask, why? And the man would say, because I said so, uh-oh. And so they couldn't understand how trying to raise this black boy, I had to give him some rights.
Sure.
And but in the end, I did spank him when he was about 7.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd gone into my purse and taken some chewing gum. I asked, where did you get that? He said, in your purse. So I told him, you know you're not supposed to go into my purse. You know that. Why did you do it? He said, I wanted it. So I gave him a spanking. And when I finished, he said, I said, I hope you never do that again. He said, so do I. So I said, after I've given you a seeing to, you still have lip? He said, I hope you never hit me again. Do you realize how big you are? I'm only 7 years old. So I told him, all right. I promise you I'll never hit you again.
Yeah.
And I never did.
Aww.
I said, but on the other hand, you will have to convince me and explain to me why you're going against something I've asked you not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he was 10, because every time he'd do something, I'd save up until he wanted to go someplace.
Hmm.
And I'd just sit down, please, and explain to me why you did what you did last month, last week.
Mm-hmm.
His mom, they're waiting for me. Our team is going to play. No, I'm sorry. Please, explain to me. And so finally, by the time he was 10, he asked me, why don't you give me a spanking like other kids? Why don't you and let me go to... No. So, of course, I had to raise him, and that was the only way I had. And he said, he's told this many times. People ask him, how did it feel growing up in Maya Angelou's shadow? He said, in her shadow. I was raised in her light.
Oh.
She seemed to see me all the time. I got very uncomfortable.
You have so many quotes I love, but one of my favorites is, a bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song.
That's right.
Can you talk about the importance of singing your song, of expressing your soul, your voice to the world?
Well, the truth is, nobody can beat being you but you.
Yeah.
And it's pitiful when you see people trying to imitate other people.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, they have their own way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is said that no snowflake is alike, I don't know who has managed and measured all the snowflakes, but I know that no human being is exactly alike. We come here alone. And we may have the blessing to fall in love with someone,
mm-hmm,
or have some family member with whom one feels so close. But the truth is, you can't be as close as a person is to herself,
mm-hmm,
to himself.
Mm-hmm.
So you have something to say, some gift to give the world. You're here for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the Creator ever lost any of its creativity. So I have a role to play. I have something I'm supposed to do. I believe that.
You speak all over the country at so many different universities, inspiring graduating classes as they prepare to go out into the world. And I think this is such a pivotal time for young adults, and you give so many inspiring words of advice for their journey. Can you tell us one of your favorite pieces of advice about life?
Yes, I really got this from James Baldwin.
Uh-huh.
And the statement is, you've already been paid for.
Oh, I love that.
And I love it. And I say whether your ancestors came from Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm,
trying to escape the pogroms, the little and large murders,
mm-hmm,
if they came from Ireland trying to escape the potato blight, which is here, not only Ireland, but the area which was to become Germany, and it was also assailed by the potato blight.
Mm-hmm.
If the ancestors came from Asia in the 1850s to build this country, to build the railroads, unable legally to bring their mates or spouses,
mm-hmm.
or to even own property in the land they were helping to develop, building the roads and the railroads. And if the ancestors came from South America, from the islands, and if indeed the ancestors came from Africa unwillingly, lying spoon fashion in the filthy hatches of slave ships, and in each other's excrement and urine and menstrual flow, they have paid for each of us already.
Mm.
And Jimmy Baldwin said that, then I took it as far as I could take it, mm-hmm. with that idea,
mm-hmm.
realizing that all I really had to do was prepare myself so I could pay for someone else who was yet to come.
Oh, beautiful. Your presence and your words have inspired millions all around the world. I'm curious, who or what inspires you these days?
Love it inspires me. Love between a man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman, an adult and a child.
Mm-hmm.
A child, yes, love inspires me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can be inspired by a country song or a song of Ray Charles.
Mm-hmm.
I can be inspired by the poetry of Eugene Redmond and Amiri Baraka. And Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Nikki Giovanni. Yes.
Yes.
I can be inspired.
Beautiful.
By Sylvia Plath.
And speaking of university appearances, I know you'll be here in Indianapolis at Butler University next week on September 25th. We're really looking forward to having you here.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to being there. You have a great poet living in Indianapolis, Marie Evans.
Yes.
One of the great poets in English.
Oh.
I love her work.
Well, you've honored us for being on today's program. Thank you so much, Dr. Angelou, for the work that you're doing in the world and the light that you're shining.
Thank you. Will you please come backstage and say hello to me?
I will do that, ma'am.
I would love that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
I am so looking forward to meeting this amazing woman. We're going to have much more of the program, but first, here's a word from our sponsors. Finding a spiritual home can be challenging. Imagine a place where you can be you, instead of trying to fit into a box. A place where there is joy and inner peace, positive and practical spirituality, wisdom and beauty in all spiritual paths. A place that feels like home, spiritually progressive, always growing, building community beyond ourselves. Welcome to Journey's Fire Spiritual Center, a vibrant and diverse community that includes people of different ages, races, religious backgrounds, and sexual orientation. Journey's Fire Spiritual Center. Sunday celebration begins at 10 a.m. Come and be inspired to shine. For location and more information, our website is journeysfirespiritualcenter.org or call 317-796-1897. Journey's Fire Spiritual Center, sharing love, honoring all paths, celebrating life.
Are you passionate about alternative medicine and natural health, nutrition, fitness, personal growth, or just living lighter on the earth? The Natural Awakenings magazine is a local guide to a healthier and more balanced life for you and your family. Natural Awakenings can be found at area health food and grocery stores, fitness centers, yoga studios, libraries, retail locations, and wherever free publications are found. In each monthly issue, you'll find timely local, national, and global stories about nutrition, alternative and complementary medicine, fitness for your body and mind, organic foods, recipes, and so much more. Natural Awakenings magazine is a way for advertisers to reach health-conscious readers that actively support like-minded businesses and service providers. For more information, the number is 317-862-6332 to learn about advertising opportunities. The website is nacrossroads.com. That's nacrossroads.com.
I'd like to share with you one of my favorite Dr. Angelou quotes. She writes, "I've learned that no matter what happens, or how bad it seems today, life does go on, and it will be better tomorrow. I've learned that you can tell a lot about a person by the way he, she handles these three things: a rainy day, lost luggage, and tangled Christmas tree lights. I've learned that regardless of your relationship with your parents, you'll miss them when they're gone from your life. I've learned that making a living is not the same thing as making a life. I've learned that life sometimes gives you a second chance. I've learned that you shouldn't go through life with a catcher's mitt on both hands. You need to be able to throw something back. I've learned that whenever I decide something with an open heart, I usually make the right decision. I've learned that even when I have pains, I don't have to be one. I've learned that every day you should reach out and touch someone. People love a warm hug or just a friendly pat on the back. I've learned that I still have a lot to learn. And I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel. And once again, Dr. Maya Angelou will be here in Indianapolis Wednesday night, September 25th, at Butler University Clues Hall. Her lecture begins at 7:30 p.m. And in closing, we have a real treat. We're going to be playing an encore presentation of an interview I did several years ago with best-selling author Marianne Williamson. We're talking about her book, Everyday Grace. Well, Marianne Williamson, welcome to Journey's Fire.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's talk about reclaiming our magic, because that's what you do so well in your new book.
Thank you.
How's that going for you so far? You're on a book tour right now.
Oh, it's going really well, and I think when you talk about a subject like reclaiming our magic, what I talk about in the introduction of the book is that, you know, this phenomenon by which children and really adults also just obsessively have been reading the Harry Potter book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that speaks to a deep hunger that we all feel,
mm-hmm.
to experience some lost dimension of our own selfhood. We relate to this concept that muggles are missing out on the magic of existence, because I think there's a parallel there to a deep truth about our own culture. You know, we really are a bunch of silly muggles who are missing out on the magic of existence. So what I wanted to inquire about in writing this book, the idea that we too can reclaim the magic of our true selves, that there's a Harry Potter in all of us, that we really do have a magic mark on our forehead. And I think that for those of us who have believed for a long time that there's something more, I think that the conditions of the world are such that this is clearly the time to make whatever magic is in us actually happen.
Well, and you encourage the reader that to help reclaim that magic, there's a mystical path that they can choose to go on, which I believe what you write in the book is the difference between the limitations of a mortal perspective or the spiritual freedom that emanates from the mind of God. Big difference.
Yes. You know, once again, going back to the Harry Potter image, Harry Potter is told that he can get to the magical kingdom from at the station, from the place in the station, which is 9 3/4,
mm-hmm.
station stop 9 3/4. Well, to the mortal eye, there is no 9 3/4. There's 9, and then there's 10. And so he said, well, there is no 9 3/4. He could not perceive a 9 3/4 with his mortal mind or his physical senses. But he was told, just believe that 9 3/4 is there, and as you do, and you walk into it, then that will be your portal. And so I think that that's what faith is like. If you have faith in another world, then another world opens up to you. And that's where we are right now. We are standing before a kind of veil of illusion, thinking that that's reality, that that's all there is, because that's what our physical senses are showing us. But there's a realm of peace and harmony and beauty and perfection which lies beyond the veil. And with faith, we invoke it into expression, and that's where we are, I think, as a species.
Well, faith having to do also in choosing love over fear.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Because the realm of illusion is the realm of fear, and we can choose love instead.
You say also in your book that when we forget that we are love, then we forget to love.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That our identity is love, our genuine reality is love, and we are, as it were, hanging out in a realm of consciousness which is alien to our natural being.
Mm-hmm.
Because our natural being is love, and here we are living on a planet dominated by fear. No wonder we feel crazed, neurotic, stressed, like we're aliens in our own, on our own planet. No wonder we feel something off inside. It's because something is off in this world.
Mm-hmm. And the mystic has tools available to them, spiritual principles. You equate them to like magic wands. Talk about those wands for a minute.
Well, I'm fascinated by the story of Cinderella and what happens when the fairy godmother shows up and points her wand in the direction of circumstances that then transform because she does. I think that there's a real metaphysical equivalent to this, and that is that a wand is a kind of focused thought or principle. And when you apply the thinking, a certain kind of thinking to a situation, then that situation does transform. So the principles or wands that I talk about in the book, there are five of them.
Mm-hmm.
One is the thought, as you stand within any situation, that no matter what's going on now, a miracle could happen, that I'm open to the possibility of infinite possibility. Number two, the realization that every thought of judgment I think blocks the light. Number three, that we are the angels we're waiting for, that we must become in the circumstances that matter to us, people that display the characteristics of the greatest nobility and virtue and love and blessing. Number four is related to that. It's that the end is inherent in the means, meaning who we become, who we are as people, ultimately determines where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And the fifth one is that sacred silence writes the universe, which is just another way of saying that prayer and meditation every day makes all the difference.
And it really begins with law of cause and effect. What we put out will come back to us.
Absolutely.
Where we
that's
place
really
our faith.
The crux of it, isn't it? That's why the golden rule is at the heart of all great religious teaching.
You mention in your book something that I really appreciated, and that is it's our task of our generation to turn love into a social force. Can love be the answer when we are at a point where there's so many interesting things developing throughout the world?
Well, it's not just that love can be the answer, it's that love is the only real answer. You know, military and political solutions can manage the effects of hatred, but they can't dismantle the thought system of hatred. And hatred harnessed is what terrorism is. Terrorism is what's happened because relatively few people have harnessed the power of hate. They've become proactive behind hate. They've trained in ways to express hate. They have an image and a vision of what they want the world to look like, and they're willing to do what it takes to make that happen. Well, the only real antidote to that is for us to do with love what they've done with hate. It's time for us to harness the powers of love, the way Gandhi did, the way Martin Luther King did. We must harness the powers of love. We must stand convicted around love. We must have an image and a vision of what we want the world to look like. We must train, which is what a mystical journey is, in ways of becoming conduits for love. Behind everything that's going on in the world is a great spiritual contest between the ways of fear and the ways of love. And the only way we can really weigh in on the side of love is by seeking to triumph within our own selves, that we might become conduits of it more effectively in our own environments and in the world than we ever have been before.
So really, we're not to ignore what you might call the darkness, but we're to transform it by the light.
Right. There's a difference between denial and transcendence. Denial that just means I'm not going to look at it, that's not transcendent. That's a negative denial. Positive denial is when you're willing to look at something in the eye, but to simply deny its power over you, given that you are a child of God.
Mm-hmm. So how do we raise this consciousness globally in terms of the transforming power of love as a social force?
Well, I don't think that we can try to change other people. I think we begin by making sure that we ourselves are doing as well as we can. And when we do that, it's like God gives you a piece of the garden to tend to. And when you've tended to your own piece of the garden, a bigger piece is given you. So I don't think any of us can like set out to take the globe, but we can we can reclaim our own lives. And as we do so, the capacity that we have within our own lives to be of greatest effect, that begins to just happen automatically.
How much of that, Marianne, is people not understanding just who they are as a child of God?
Well, theoretically, that's everything. Theoretically, that's the essential problem. That's the essential original sin. Sin is an archery term. It means you miss the mark. It means a misperception. So the original misperception is that we've forgotten who we are. We have forgotten that we are creations of an infinitely powerful God who has actually shared that power with us. And when our hearts are aligned with his love and his blessing, then miracles arise automatically out of what we say, what we do, and what we think. And we have been trained to not believe that. And for us to unlearn the thinking of the world and to relearn the thinking of grace, of blessing, of forgiveness, and of love will lift us into another dimension of experience entirely. And as we are lifted, then everything that does not resonate with that falls of its own dead weight.
And that as children of God, which I believe and you believe everybody are, that we're not held back by anything when we remember that identity.
But the interesting thing is it's one thing to believe that. It's one thing to abstractly embrace it as an intellectual concept. It's another thing for that information, for that principle, and for that idea to literally inform your cells, for it to affect your nervous system. And that's why I wrote this particular book, because I notice in myself how sometimes powerful ideas that I'm totally committed to, totally embrace, have not yet reached my nervous system. It's not just that you're some bad person if you don't practice what you preach. It's that it's hard sometimes to practice the ideals that we believe in. And then, so that's the work, I think, that this generation of spiritual seekers is about right now. Not learning new spiritual information. We have the information. God, we've all read the same books. We've all listened to the same tapes. I think the buzz of this moment is, how do I actually manifest this in every area of my life?
That's what I like about your book, because for our listeners, it breaks down everyday life. You talk about work, you talk about relationships, you talk about jealousy,
yeah,
grief.
Well, those are the issues that actually inform our daily experience. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, believe in love and believe in God and believe in miracles, and it's another thing to handle it when you lose your job or when you feel jealous because somebody got a break and you didn't, or mm-hmm. when you're grieving or you feel guilty because of some mistake you made. You know, it's not always that easy to apply these principles in those areas of life that actually make up our daily living.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back and talk a little bit about wand, I think number three, about thoughts of judgment that block the light.
Oh, it's such a big one, isn't it?
Because
we know that we should be less judgmental. We know how much it hurts when people judge us. We know that in the Bible it says, judge not lest ye be judged. And yet, if we take an honest look at our own minds, look at the people we're judging. And I know for me, sometimes the mind is very sly, and so I'll say to myself, well, it's not a big judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I have that chapter in the book, because any thought of judgment blocks the light. A little judgment is still a shadow across the sun, every bit as much as a big judgment is. So, you know, once you start applying this stuff to your own mind, you really see you have a full-time job just healing yourself.
Well, and we need to do that. I've been recently attending a couple of peace rallies in this area, and I have to admit that the rhetoric I was hearing was anything but peaceful.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that, because that's really a buzz I hear out there a lot. You're so right, and it's such an important issue. An angry generation will not bring peace to the world. If you disagree, for instance, with President Bush's policies on Iraq, and I know I certainly do, many of us do, but if we articulate that opposition in a way that dishonors him personally or that casts aspersions on the entire, you know, side of the political spectrum that he represents, then we're actually not conduits of peace, no matter what we say, because everything we do will be infused with the energy with which we do it.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned how the mystic, the spiritual person, views any problem as a chance to use his or her magic wand.
Well, I think that really gets into it, doesn't it? An example of what you're saying. I mean, we might say something like, you know, we believe in love and peace, but then something happens politically and somehow all of a sudden those principles don't apply here.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are going to infuse the world with a new consciousness, we have to infuse every corner of it with new consciousness. And that's why your example is such a good point.
Well, we started earlier about talking about reclaiming our magic. Talk about miracles, because there are going to be some people who said, yeah, I hear that, but do miracles really exist today? Can I have a miracle in my life?
Well, it's interesting, because if you ask just the average person, do you believe in miracles, the vast majority of people in the United States would say that they do. We've all heard of situations where people have miraculous healings, spontaneous remissions of cancer and other terminal illnesses. We have all read stories of people who had something horrible happen, like their child pinned under a car, and they just lifted the car. I mean, most people, you know, you don't have to just look to the parting of the Red Sea or the raising of Lazarus to say, you know, I believe these things happen, not just in story, but in situations that I've heard of or that I've witnessed. But then once again, the issue is, okay, if you believe that, then how convicted are you that in this situation you're going through in your life, we could have a miracle?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Saddam Hussein is a perfect example. The Al-Qaeda is a perfect example. Are we willing to open our minds to the possibility, number one, that we could have a miracle, but number two, in order to have a miracle, we have to be willing to see things the way God would have us see them.
I'm speaking with Marianne Williamson. Marianne, you also talk in your book, I believe it's 1, number 5, and that's Sacred Silence Writes the Universe. Let's talk about the power of meditation, the power of prayer, because that's really so needed.
Well, every great religious system stresses it. You wake up in the morning and your mind is most open to receive new impressions. Now, the vast majority of people take a shower in the morning, right? Because
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't dream of going out into the day carrying on our bodies the accumulated dirt from yesterday. It's just a given. And it would be ludicrous to say, oh, you know, I'm so busy, I just had to give up washing my body, right? Now, when it comes to the psyche, the heart, the mind, the emotions, the issue is very similar. We need to cleanse ourselves of the accumulated stress and frenzy and toxicity and kind of mind pollution from the day before. And when it comes to the psyche, we don't just carry our own stress. We carry the stress of the entire world through the media, et cetera. So when you take time in the morning, whatever time you can give, but we're taught in the Course in Miracles that even 5 minutes can make a tremendous difference. And instead of rushing to the news or rushing to the newspaper or the television or the radio and adding caffeine and then going out the door, if instead we say, I will meet this morning with God before I do anything else, I will read spiritual material, I will pray, I will meditate. Before I go into the office, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to bless everybody that's in my office before I even go there. I'm going to bless every child in my classroom. I'm going to bless every client. And I'm going to ask God to take from me my judgment of anyone that I would otherwise carry into this day, because whatever judgments I carry into the day are going to determine my experience today. I mean, if we just take some time and give it to our spiritual path every morning, it makes a tremendous difference in who we are as we go through the day, and who we are as we go through the day has so much to do with what happens.
It helps remind us, I guess, who we are, and therefore we're not held back by anything, and it also gives us new eyes in which to see the world or see our situation.
Exactly. Exactly. And in the Course in Miracles, it says we are heir to the laws that rule the world that we believe in. So if you believe in yourself, as simply a mortal, limited mortal creature, surrounded by, you know, huge forces over which you have no control, if that's the be-all and end-all of your self-perception, then that's your choice, but that will definitely be your experience.
Mm-hmm.
But if we embrace the notion that we are more than mortal beings, we're spiritual beings. We're children of God. And as Jesus said, you know, greater works than I've done, you can do. If we ask ourselves, did he mean that? And if it's true, wow, what about right now? Because we could really use, you know, some, you know, parting of the Red Sea capacity. We could really use that right now. Is that true? And to actually practice the principles of love and forgiveness that we've been taught paved the way for miracles.
Mm-hmm.
If we do that now, it will transform human history.
You have a lot of wonderful stories in this book. You tell one in terms of using prayer and making decisions about a friend who was thinking about running for mayor or not. And it was just, well, have you asked God? Is this
right.
The best way I can serve?
It was fascinating. He was giving me all this political calculation. He was running for mayor of a town in Florida. And he, you know, I said, well, are you going to run? He said, well, I don't know, because so-and-so might run for Congress that year, or so-and-so might run for mayor, or somebody else, governor, so I don't know, and some people say I should, and some people say I shouldn't, and maybe I should work in the community, you know, just on and on, and I said, wow, you know, have you considered just letting God make the decision? And he said, well, how do you do that? And I said, well, let's just pray. So we prayed, and we said, God, you know, you live outside of time. You know what's going to happen in the future. We don't. We just want, I don't know what the name I use in the book. In the real life, his name is Francisco. We just want Francisco's career to serve you and be what you would want it to be. And he said, oh, thank you so much. I feel so much more peaceful after saying that prayer. So about 15 minutes later, it was actually sooner than 15 minutes. It was 5 minutes later. He calls me. He says, you will not believe what just happened. I said, what happened? He said, 2 minutes after we got off the phone, I get a phone call. And it's from the editor of the local newspaper. And he was calling me to tell me that tomorrow in the paper, they are running a full-page ad placed anonymously that simply says, run, Frank, run.
How obvious is that?
Yeah, how obvious is that? So sometimes the answers aren't as obvious as that one, but I thought it was such an amazing story, I included it in the book.
So when you think about that, and you think about the power of prayer, and I know through your interfaith fellowship up in the Warren, Michigan, you have peace circles. If we could get more people enlisting spiritual forces, we really could see this world transformed.
Well, absolutely. Once again, you look at terrorism. All that terrorism is a very few people who have harnessed the power of hate.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take many people to turn a ship.
Mm-hmm.
But we now have to do the same with love. And yes, people can go to my website, marianne.com, and go from there to the Global Renaissance Alliance website, renaissancealliance.org, and download what we call the Peace Circle Handbook, and learn how they can form peace circles where we together form a field of prayer and blessing that will uplift the consciousness of the human race.
It seems to me that one of the keys is also, and you address this in the book as well, recognizing other people's love and innocence, which can be challenging for some people.
Well, it's challenging for all of us sometimes. I mean, it's easy enough to love people when they're behaving the way we'd like them to, but life isn't like that. And, you know, the line in the Bible and in the Course in Miracles that comes to mind is, blessed are those who have faith who cannot see. It's easy to bless the love in someone when the love is what they're showing. But the rubber meets the road where someone is not showing us their love, and we bless them anyway. Also in the Bible, Jesus said, bless your enemies and pray for those who curse you. What an astounding idea. Can you imagine if we all prayed for the Al-Qaeda? And prayed for Saddam Hussein and prayed for Osama bin Laden? That's a very important issue, because most people would say, what are you talking about praying for them? As though praying for them is praying that their plans be brought to fruition. The exact opposite is the case, however, because who you pray for, you pray that they be restored to their divine right mind. That's what prayer does. It heals people, restores them to their truth. Their truth is God created it.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be praying for those that we think of as our enemies and asking God to put his hand upon them and setting them free from the grip of darkness and fear that has them hostage.
And it's through that prayer and it's through that daily reminder, if not hour by hour reminder, of who we are as children of God,
right,
that our minds can be transformed.
Right. Right.
And as you've often said, how can we heal the world until we heal ourselves?
Well, it's the same thing, though. You know, when you pray for someone else, the prayer is for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't wait till we're all healed before we go out and pray for others either. I think there are a lot of hours in the day, and the work on praying for others and work on praying for ourselves is pretty much the same work.
Marianne, it's been a delight. I want to thank you for sharing your journey with
us. Oh, thank you so much.
And that's today's program. Thanks for sharing your time with us. Our website is richardbrendan.org, and this has been a Journeys Fire production. And so for engineer Joe Bainline and production coordinator Monica Tennell, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Oh, what a great audience. Let's dim the lights for this next one. Nope, too much. Ah, there it is. Got to get things just right. Like Progressive's Name Your Price tool. Tell us what you want to pay, and we help you find coverage options that fit your budget. And now, the mood is right. Wait, the lights are back on again. Trudy, can you? And now it's completely dark.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.